The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For your most curated, intelligent news, data, and insights, visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today for our complimentary newsline and magazine using our new chat feature.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul. Thank you for joining us. We always appreciate your listenership. On the program today is Craig Wischner. He is the founder and managing partner of Farmland LP, and he's deeply steeped in all things agriculture and farmland. And we all know what's happening right now when it comes to food. Prices are going up. Well, so is the price of farmland. And if you own some of it right now, you got to be feeling pretty good about that. If you're looking to buy it, it's a little bit pricey, but we'll talk to Craig about how things are going to play out from here going forward, in his estimation. Farmland prices right now, they're setting records. There was a sale in Iowa just last month or the month before. An investor group sold property or purchased property for $26,000 an acre. And those rising prices are expected to entice more sellers, which is an opportunity for investors who are looking to buy. Craig Wischner, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Tell me, what is going on in farmland? We're seeing these record prices. We're seeing inflation in food. How would you summarize the situation right now in farmland and agriculture from an investor standpoint?
Great. So farmland is a great asset. We actually consider it commercial real estate. For example, there's $2.7 trillion worth of farmland in the U.S. That's the same economic value as all of the apartment buildings in the U.S. or all of the office buildings in the U.S. And 54% of U.S. farmland is leased. So farmland is commercial real estate. The thing that makes it really interesting is that the value of farmland is based on the value of the crops that are grown on that land. Part of that gets turned into rent, and that forms essentially the cap rate, which sets the overall value of farmland. So, and so, for example, our fund, we basically buy great farmland, growing low value commodity crops, and then grow higher value crops through converting it to organic and other things. But when you look at the overall farmland market, what you see is a situation where farmland overall has been historically undervalued. It's delivered stable returns for the last 90 years. Farmland has delivered 11% annualized returns, about 50%, half of that from cash flow and half of that from appreciation. And those are unlevered numbers. And there's only 14% debt on the entire sector. So it really is a very not correlated with the other asset classes, yet delivers very stable long-term returns. What you're seeing right now in the market is, yes, that $26,000 an acre sale in Iowa was a record for the area. And about half of the cropland in the U.S., about 53% of U.S. cropland, grows two commodity crops, corn and soy. And most of that is in the Midwest. And that is basically your very liquid market. That's the market that responds the quickest to money printing and commodity prices and things like that. So you're seeing records over there. Across the U.S., at least over the past 12 months, you've seen appreciation of around 7 to 10% over the past 12 months. But there is a lot of pressure. A lot of increased buying demand on there, that's driven by both inflation and lowered cap rates across all other asset classes in the world, but also through some of the inflation factors that are driving increased food prices and other costs.
So you mentioned corn and soy. What and you mentioned that the farmland is really the value of it's a reflection of what's being grown on it. So what are the really pricey crops that are grown? What really pulls the most money out there in the market or best increases the value of farmland? Obviously, everybody can't be growing the same thing or you flood the market. So talk a little bit about that in the calculation as to what to grow once you've bought farmland and you're looking to lease it to growers.
That's great. So, you know, the kind of crops, first it starts out with when we're buying farmland, we look at three major factors. We say sunshine, dirt, and water. So we're buying sunshine is a great growing climate. Dirt is high quality soils. And water for us is both the legal ownership of water and the physical access to water. A lot of farmland in the U.S. is rain fed as well. And so it's kind of that combination of those factors, as well as proximity to markets, that determines what kind of crops you can grow where. And then within that subset, frankly, government subsidies drives a large part of what gets planted in the U.S. That's why you have 53% of U.S. cropland growing corn and soy, when kind of a much more sustainable level would be closer to, on the order of 15-20% maybe at the high end. But the commodity markets are ones where you don't get paid for quality, and you just get paid for quantity. So that is your corn, soy, wheat, et cetera. There are higher value crops where quality becomes more important on there, and they're just simply higher value crops. And there you're looking at some of the vegetables and specialty crops, or what we call permanent crops. Those are things that you, the other crops I've been talking about are once a year crops, rather than crops that you plant once and then produce, wine grapes or blueberries, where you plant, or fruit trees, where you plant these trees and then they grow for a number of years, and then you're able to harvest them for the long haul. And there, from a return perspective, if you're buying corn land in the Midwest, right now you're getting maybe a 2-3% yield on that. On the permanent crop side, it's more in the kind of 7-9%. Return range. And if you can do things like we do, where you're buying low value cropland and then switching it to either certified organic farmland or other things, you can increase, we've basically demonstrated that we buy farmland that's generating rents at $300 an acre, take it through a 3-year organic conversion period, and then get rents of $700 an acre.
Now, for the investors interested in farmland, but they're really focused on liquidity, and by liquidity, I mean being able to get in and out of it quickly. There are a plethora of ESG funds and maybe mutual funds that are farmland or agriculturally themed. Is that the case? How many are out there? Do you have anything to say about that? Do you happen to know how many different opportunities are out there for somebody who wants to really take a fund approach because they want to, they're squeamish about locking their money up?
So there are, of the $2.7 trillion worth of farmland in the U.S., only 2% of farmland is institutionally owned. So it is a very illiquid asset class, both just because it's real estate, but also because there are so few options to invest in this. There's two publicly traded farmland REITs. Again, not a lot. And those REITs are really just focused on the sale leaseback of farmland. So, one of them focuses much more on Midwestern farmland. And that one is kind of more volatile because you're really investing in those volatile commodity crop cycles. So while you have better liquidity there, you're really subject to a lot more volatility than you would otherwise. For our view is that farmland is this great stable, steady asset class. You should have a 5+ year holding time on this. And then it can really just, you can do some very low risk, but high impact value add strategies and get great returns both from cash flow and from appreciation on that. But there you're limited to more of the private options. We're one of the 15 largest farmland managers in the U.S. and the largest that focuses on organic and regenerative agriculture. And, you know, we manage $200 million. So that's a drop in the bucket compared to some of the other commercial real estate sectors. But it's
all about returns, market. Craig. All about returns.
It is.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's great. We've been doing this for 12 years. It's a wonderful asset class, and we have delivered great returns. You know, there are both, you know, with only 2% of the farmland institutionally owned, there's just a tremendous opportunity to buy well, to have really straightforward value add strategies that generate growth, great returns from cash flow and appreciation. The you know existing farmers they specialize, they focus, and they're great at what they do. And so we're often buying farmland from farmers who consider themselves corn farmers or wheat farmers, and they even though their farmland has the capability of growing much more valuable crops on that land, their equipment and their business, and in some ways their identity, is built around kind of growing that crop type, and that just it just creates a lot of opportunities. And fortunately, the markets, the demand for organic high value crops is so large, organic blueberries and high quality crops like wine grapes as well. The overall food market, for example, food prices over the past 12 months are up 27%. So that's across all sectors.
Wow.
So you have this kind of natural food price inflation that's going up. You have opportunities for other high value crops that go up. And again, when I started, I said that the value of farmland is based on the value of the crops that grow on that land. So when you just have this natural food price inflation, that just by the rising tide rises the cash flow that's generated by that farmland and that asset value. All the other money printing and cap rate compression and all that stuff is really just on top of that.
So along those lines, my notes here say that in 2020, U.S. organic sales rose by 12.4% to a record $62 billion, which compares with a 5% rise in 2019. What's going – and then on top of that, consumer interest in organic produce says is going to continue to climb. One forecast said that is expecting 10% growth for the market next year, meaning 2022. So what's going on here? Are we just eating smarter and better? Is that what's happening? Or is this strictly, are these people have been eating produce anyway, but they're moving to organic because they're focused on better health and cleaner diets?
Both of those. People definitely care, continue to care more about what they eat. You also have one of the most interesting phenomenons is that new mothers are the largest segment of growth in the organic sector. And so when a woman is faced with the question of starting to feed her brand new baby solid food or food that doesn't come from her body for the first time, organic milk is the largest sector. Like over 90% of new mothers want organic milk for their baby if it's not coming from their own body. And then that leads to a cascade of organic purchases. Purchasing habits shift extraordinarily when women become mothers. And actually, organic baby food from the U.S. Is one of the most in-demand exports to China. My understanding is that the 300 million middle class Chinese don't trust the Chinese food system, and they want to feed their babies U.S. grown, certified organic baby food. So,
wow, what an opportunity that is! That's a massive market. That middle class alone is almost the size of the United States, and then of course it's what China is. What, 3 to 4 times the size of the United States in terms of population. But they're also suffering from a declining birth rate, as we are, as the world is. But that certainly has not stood in the way, Craig. The numbers are still going up. I suppose maybe long-term, somebody could look at that and say, well, this is going to top off. But there's also the education component. There's so much information that's shared these days through everything is so transparent with social media and the internet. How big a component is that? Just that people are understanding better what is exactly a good diet and what's the difference to the human system between something that's grown with pesticides versus organically grown?
You know, it's important. My background, I have a degree in biochemistry and molecular biology and a minor in economics, and I grew up doing commercial real estate. Pretty quantitative background. The science of eating healthy food that's grown without the use of the toxic pesticides, it's just so compelling. There's a couple different sides of that. One is when we manage farmland, we focus on healthy soil, and that healthy biological soil. And that actually results in healthier plants. And we have very great data that shows that our yields, for example, on organic blueberries are 33% higher than other conventional growers, that are what's called the pack out rate, the amount of fruit that we pull off of the bush that passes the quality checks and goes into the clamshells is 86% versus 80% for average growers. So we can show very good quality benefits from growing healthy crops, but also there's really solid scientific data that shows that consuming a steady diet of pesticides increases cancer, increases issues for children, and a number of other issues. So there's real fundamental science behind the benefits of eating organic for yourself. Plus, if you understand the environmental impact of the billions of tons of pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers that have gone into the environment, a lot of wells in the Midwest are just simply poisoned with atrazine that then people who live in those communities just have to drink. It's hugely impactful. So there are very good personal reasons, there are very good environmental reasons for the shift to organic. It's not just about feeling good, but it also does feel good.
And then there's a whole calculation as to eating whole foods versus processed foods. I mean, supermarkets are loaded with processed foods. Anything that comes in a box or a bag is basically a processed food that's got all kinds of additives, including preservatives and things that aren't really good for health, but they make them very delicious. So they're very well calculated. They understand that the human tongue, that they like sweetness, they like salt, like things that are savory. They're really good in the laboratory at doing this, Craig. But I think more and more people are realizing that if you really want the human system to work optimally, you need to be ingesting whole foods that is grown in nature and without the assistance of pesticides made in a laboratory and so on. Anyway, well, you're a chemist and all that, or a microbiologist. I forget exactly what you said. So I'll give you a chance to comment on that, because I think you understand exactly how this works in the human system.
Look, I think you're right on. I think that actually one of the things that the kind of consumer packaged goods companies and new companies that have done very well are doing well, the combination of good marketing and branding combined with being good products as well. There are a lot of garbage products out there that are packaged that you know, the consumer nowadays is bombarded by very sophisticated marketing messages. And the consumer has to be the one to determine what's BS and what's real. And same for investors as well. Investors, there's we get our farmland certified organic or do other third-party certifications. There's a new group that calls themselves a sustainable certification that some of the largest farmland managers are getting. I call it misleading harvest. They call it leading harvest as a certification. But this is basically, you know, the farmers can basically say what they consider sustainability to be, and they write up a little report and submit it. And then they send out a certifier to say, oh, well, if this is what you say is sustainable, great, we'll give you our logo. Now, the problem is that there are counties in the U.S. where 67% of the farms in that county grow corn 9 or 10 years out of 10 in a row. Full-on monocropping corn, which is the worst agricultural practice and cannot in any way be done sustainably. And yet these companies are getting certified sustainable, and what they say is certified sustainable. And it's up to the investors to ask hard questions and really know enough to be able to separate the greenwashing from what's legitimate as well.
Now, you know, you mentioned China, that huge opportunity, but the United States and China aren't getting along all that well. The beautiful thing about produce that is imported into China, I mean, if you're a tech company, you go to China, they say, sure, you can have access to our market, but give us all your coding, all your software. Yeah, all your IP. We want your intellectual property. And as soon as we get a company up and running, we'll kick you the hell out of here and we'll build our own companies up. That doesn't happen with agriculture. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you ship the blueberries, you ship the potatoes, you ship the soybeans, and they consume them. They're not going to beat you over the head about how did you grow these things. They can figure that out for themselves. But we're not getting along right now. In Africa, I know, or rather China has been looking to Africa as a place for agricultural investment, particularly with soybeans, to a closer market, less transportation cost. And now that we're not exactly getting along, they probably are looking for opportunities to diversify away from the United States. Now, I did just read recently that China's cutting back on its investments in Africa. I'm not sure if that includes agriculture or not. What about that? Do you have any information as to whether China is kind of withdrawing from the agricultural connection to the United States, or is it as strong as ever? And they're really looking at other industries for the kind of the retaliation. And I'm not accusing China of retaliation. We do the same. So both of us are playing that game. But what about that?
So that's one of the interesting things about food is that you can only play politics with food up to a point. And that point is if you jeopardize your ability to feed your population, you've got much larger problems domestically than you would ever have internationally. So China is the world's Absolutely. Largest pork producer. They need a steady stream of corn and soy. There. And so if they can get it from Brazil or China or other places, they will. But the U.S. also has the ability. I mean, the reason why 40% of our corn crop goes to ethanol is not because we need the fuel substitute. It's actually to subsidize the farmers and get the electoral college votes. But really, it's a demand subsidy for the farmers. From a personal standpoint, I don't like the commodity crops as an investment. Really, there's a tremendous amount of volatility. A good harvest in Brazil could absolutely tank the price that you're getting, even if you've invested in, you know, modern technology to increase your yields and lower your costs in the U.S. So you could get hit really by an external factor without any control over that whatsoever. If you switch over to the higher value crops, you have very, very strong domestic markets, and you have opportunities on the export markets as well. The U.S. is really one of the strongest markets for organic food, for example. And while, you know, some companies have invested in, for example, blueberry production in Chile and Peru, what they found is that, you know, it takes 22 days for a ship to go from Chile to the United States. And so what that means is that they have to harvest those blueberries 22 days early while they're still green, put them in a container and flood it with ethylene gas to get them to turn colors. And by the time it ends up in the supermarket shelves, it's the right color, but it has no flavor. And what the supermarkets have been saying over the past couple of years is that if the consumer comes in and grabs a basket of blueberries and the blueberries have no flavor, they don't say, "Oh, I'm not buying blueberries from Chile anymore." What they say is, "Oh, I'm not buying blueberries from that supermarket anymore." And so it impacts the sales of that supermarket. So they'd rather not have blueberries if they're not high quality blueberries than have poor quality ones. And so that really increases demand and keeps that demand local in the U.S. And you know, we're just, as a country, very good at growing some of these high-value crops. And it really benefits the U.S. consumer as well by providing them with reasonably priced but very high-quality products.
You know, you make a good point. When I go to a Mexican restaurant, I base the quality of that restaurant or the attention to detail as to whether they can make a good chili relleno or they have good chips and salsa. If I walk into a supermarket and they've got lousy produce, I'd figure they're not paying attention to everything else in the store either, because produce is a real display. It's a visual display. And if they're not paying attention to that, I'm out. I want to go to a store that they're really paying attention, because if you don't get that right, I'll tell you a quick little story. I think it was the group Van Halen that... I'm pretty sure it was a rock band, Van Halen, and they used to say they wanted M&Ms, a bowl of M&Ms in the dressing room, but they wanted no green M&Ms. There's not to be any green M&Ms in there. And it sounded like it was quirky or superstition. And when they were asked about that, the person who had written, I think it was a biography about them, they said it didn't have to do with the green M&Ms. What it had to do with was attention to detail, because if they weren't paying attention, they weren't taking the green M&Ms out of there, then we were worried about the tons of equipment on that stage that was hanging over our heads, the lighting, the sound system, and everything else that they might not have been paying attention to. There were larger issues there. So if you're not going to get rid of those green M&Ms, you're not reading the contract in our specifications closely enough for us to trust you. So, I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's a clever, very clever little play they did there. But again, going into a supermarket and seeing a bad produce section is not a good thing.
That is absolutely right on. And while we wish that you know, we have this kind of mental image of farmers being good stewards of the land, and in general they are, but you know, with only 2% of farmland institutionally owned and most farmland farmed by family farmers, and with 53% of U.S. farmland growing corn and soy and the vast majority of it just growing general commodity crops, you know, all the pesticide use, the fertilizers, the herbicides, the problems that we're having is really a function of the existing farmers and the existing agriculture system that we have. And it, I know the things that we do on our land when no one's looking. For me, this is about creating great farmland for my daughter's generation. She's 15, and it's really about creating a sustainable future for her generation. And so we make choices that are based on the long haul. A lot of them provide great economic benefits and great sustainability benefits, but some of them don't. And some of them show up in great quality in the fruit, for example, that creates great partnerships for us. But some of them don't. But it really does matter who's managing the farmland and what you do with it. Some of it shows up in quality. Some of it doesn't. So,
is the United States the world's farming superpower?
We're an extraordinary market. So I think the number that I heard was that we have 25% of the world's high quality farmland in the U.S. And we have amazing soils, amazing water. We have great growing climates, and we also have amazing infrastructure, very high quality, meaning like roads and ports for transportation. We have amazing equipment. We're a wealthy country compared to most of the world. So we're able to afford high quality equipment, which increases our efficiency. And we also have great farmers who just do very well operating at scale. And scale is the number one item that correlates with profitability in agriculture. Yeah, we are an extraordinary producer. Now, countries like Brazil, for example, are really expanding their agricultural production, but they're doing it on relatively poor quality land, and they're doing it by tearing out the Amazon.
So, yeah, terrible.
So,
and they're not doing that for farmland strictly, Craig, correct? No, I mean, they're raising a lot of cattle, and they need grazing land, so they're tearing out the rainforest, which is just so depressing to hear what's going on there.
Well, and so the cattle are actually a step up on the value add production chain. So they started out basically dramatically expanding their corn and soy production, and they did not have the roads or the ports to get all of that corn and soy to the international markets like China. And so they had all this excess production. And so feeding that to local livestock actually creates a more value add product and uses up some of that extra components. So there's a business reason for that as well. Some of it, yes, is just the grazing land, but some of it is also in some ways expands the corn and soy production in the country.
Where is the richest soil in the world? Is that Africa? Is it the United States? Is it somewhere in Asia? Where do you get super rich soil?
So there are two wonderful areas of soil in the U.S. One of them is in the Chernobyl region of the Ukraine.
Know why, right?
Well,
because it's been untouched for a while, and of course you can't grow there. Is that right? Or can you? You can't access it. It's a demilitarized zone, so to speak.
This is a little bit disturbing if you want to go down that path. But actually, that is a great agricultural region. The soils are really amazing. The USSR put the nuclear plant there as a form of economic development for the community. And then when it blew up, yes, radioactivity went all over the area. A lot of that land has now been reopened and is growing wheat, for example.
Is it okay to eat? I mean, is it Does it absorb any of the radiation or does it not end up in the food?
Well,
do you know?
I don't think that wheat is allowed to come to the U.S. is one answer. And the second question, the second part of that answer is that I do have a Geiger counter.
Oh, there you go.
So, plants do uptake the minerals. So if you have cesium and other heavy metals around, plants uptake the minerals and metals. And some plants preferentially store them in their seeds. Mm. So it's some in their fruit. It really depends on the plants as well. There's something called bioremediation where you actually grow plants specifically to bioaccumulate the toxins. They do those in Superfund sites, for example, in the U.S. But then you have to treat the plants as toxic waste. You dry them down and then you burn them and then you keep the ash and you can store the ash very effectively. But it's a very efficient way of detoxifying topsoil. So, but let's talk about
it. So look for the Chernobyl label and stay away from it. Exactly. Bottom line. Is there anywhere else in the world you'd point to? Is Africa a super rich growing region?
Some parts of it, but really actually the second really wonderful area is the United States. The United States in the Midwest during the prior ice age, that land was covered in glaciers, like a mile high. And the glaciers basically ground down the rocks and the granite and created this really wonderful, rich, fertile soil. And it actually goes up into Canada a little bit. The Midwest and then also on the West Coast as well, there are certain areas that, for example, in Washington, at the end of the Ice Age, you had these glaciers, and basically the water would melt on the inside of the glaciers, and basically it would form a giant ice dam. And multiple dozens of times, it would create these gigantic ice dams that would then fail. And you'd have 100 to 1,000 feet of water rushing across the landscape towards the West Coast. And it would carry along all of the topsoil to kind of choke points before it went out to the Pacific Ocean. And all that beautiful topsoil would settle down along the West Coast and create these now wonderfully fertile regions as well. So there are pockets of just really amazing topsoil. There are other areas around the world that I'm not particularly expert on, generally because there are other issues that to me make them challenging to invest in.
Mm. Now, in my notes, I did find here that it says U.S. sustainable funds, sustainable agriculture funds saw $39 billion in net inflows in the first half of this year. That was according to Morningstar. So, investors are on the chase. What role, and this might be outside your expertise, Craig, but our listeners would, of course, be interested to know what you see as the role agriculture or farmland should be playing in a portfolio, an investment portfolio.
That's great. Well, so I wouldn't call all farmland funds sustainable, but we certainly are. And that overall sustainable sector is important. But there's a separate question there, which is kind of two questions. One is, what role does farmland play in a portfolio? And then what component, how can you kind of get that in a sustainable way, I would say. And, but in general, farmland as an asset class fits very nicely into portfolios. You might have heard that Bill Gates is the largest individual owner of farmland in the U.S. And, we actually looked at, and we know what farms he owns, and we can do some math on that. And we estimate that he owns around $5 billion worth of farmland in the U.S. And his total net worth is around $147 billion. So for him, that's just a nice bit of an allocation to farmland. And in general, when people are constructing portfolios, farmland fits in the real assets segment of the portfolio, mm-hmm. which tends to increase returns and reduces volatility in portfolios. And so 5 to 7 to even 10% of a portfolio in farmland is a good number because it has that that 11% annualized unlevered returns, half from cash flow, half from appreciation, doesn't correlate with the stock market, doesn't correlate with the debt markets, and really is just this slow and steady way that wins the race over decades. So farmland is just this wonderful cash flowing asset. It's also very inflation protected. As all of these food prices increase and overall overall inflation really continues to grow, farmland is one of the best essentially hedges and really benefits from inflation and money printing.
You're never going to have to worry about people stopping eating. They're going to keep eating. We know that, but you got to do it right if you want to be in the game. So, you know, as we talked about, so our guest has been Craig Wischner. He is founder and managing partner of Farmland LP, founded in 2009. He's responsible for the day-to-day management, business strategy, and investment activity of the organization, and obviously a deep knowledge of the subject matter. Craig, thank you for taking the time. It's such a an interesting category. We're all it's relevant to everybody. That's part of it. Is that you know everybody's got to eat. Everybody cares about good food, and it's relevant to everybody. And it's just from an investment standpoint, it is performing exceptionally well right now. Thank you for taking the time.
Mike, great speaking with you.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.